Okay, we want to welcome you to the next session of the Sunstone Symposium. My name is Steve Bradford. I'm chairing this session. Happy to have my godfather here, Robert Reese. We want to just also remind you, if you would turn off your cell phones so we don't have any interruption. We're going to be recording this session today. And so if you want to get a session recording of this or any other sessions, you can do that. The topic today is Glenn Beck. So if you're not here for Glenn Beck, then go elsewhere. This is going to be a highly intellectual presentation. Glenn Beck inspires that. So
I'm here to be against Glenn.
Get ready. Just a little bit of information about our speaker, Bob Reese. There are three people that have had a lot of influence on me in my life as a Latter-day Saint. The first is actually Mary and Charles Bradford, who raised me, and they've had a lot of influence. The other person would be Jean England, who I got to spend some time with when I was attending BYU, and then the other person would be Robert Reese. I find it interesting that Brother Reese and Brother England collaborated on a Reader's Book of Mormon, which was published several years after Gene's death, so I've often wondered how Bob channeled Gene during that process. I would highly recommend a Reader's Book of Mormon. It's the first edition of the Book of Mormon with introductions by folks like Bob Reese and Jean England and Doug Fair and Claudia Bushman. And it's been a real wonderful experience for me to go through that first edition with the editing and essays that you get to read, introducing each section of that seven-volume set. Bob Reese has published a lot of other things. I'm always interested whenever I read something by him. His biography is always slightly different, depending on what he's doing or who he's addressing. One of the things I'm grateful to Bob for is that he actually gave me a temple recommend one time so that I could go to the Los Angeles Temple and get married. I was very grateful to him for that. That's on his biography occasionally, that he served as the bishop of the Los Angeles First Ward, responsible for getting a lot of people out of that ward through marriage and other things. He, of course, has published extensively. He was the editor of Dialogue before my mom became editor back in the 70s. He probably wants me to push his latest tome, which is called Why I Stay, The Challenges of Discipleship for Contemporary Mormons, which will be published by Signature in December. And so without further ado, we'll turn the time over to Bob. He has no respondent because no one was brave enough to come forward. So he may respond to himself after he opens it up to questions.
Thank you, Steve. If you're interested, even though I'm not a bishop, I still give out temple recommends. So having trouble just let me know. I start with two quotes, one from Jane McCabe. Through anger, the truth always looks simple. And the other by Carolyn Hacks. Being negative is easy. There will always be a downside to everything good, a hurdle to everything desirable, a con to every pro. The real courage is in finding the good in what you have, the opportunities in every hurdle, the pros in every con. I have a confession to make. For the past year, I've been watching, listening to, reading, and yes, studying Glenn Beck. I've also been thinking about him a lot. All this might account for my insomnia and the more than usual crankiness of late. Glenn Beck, famous Mormon and Fox News firebrand, is a work in, well, I was going to say progress, but somehow that word doesn't quite seem right, given Beck's abhorrence for the word progressive. The political philosophy that he considers not only the greatest threat to the American way of life, but a downright execrable philosophy. One of the problems of coming to terms with Glenn Beck is trying to understand which Glenn Beck. In many ways, he's a chameleon, an enigma, a shapeshifter. He seems to be constantly reinventing himself. His career has gone from zoo radio to stand-up comic to stand-up political commentator entertainer, although it is sometimes difficult to tell the difference, since at times one finds all of these personae in Beck's shows. Among other things, Beck identifies himself as a rodeo clown, an entertainer, just a dad, a super patriot, a Mormon, and most of all, a defender and truth teller out to save America and possibly the world. He might also be labeled a journalistic Jeremiah, one who sees the world rushing headlong toward destruction, or a Pied Piper of populism. A Latter-day Saint friend of mine calls him a cross between a professional wrestler and a televangelist, and another calls him a propaganda prostitute. His critics might call him the Barnum and Bailey of talk radio and television. When I couldn't sleep the other night after watching one of his programs, the phrase that came to my mind was architect of the absurd. As conservative commentator Mark Levin remarked recently, I have no idea what philosophy Glenn Beck is promoting, and neither does he. It's incoherent. One day it's populist, the next day it's libertarian, bordering on anarchy. Next, it's conservatism, but not really, etc. Senator Robert Byrd's recent characterization of certain Republican politicians' rantings as, quote, barkings from the nether regions of Glenn Beckistan, end of quote, suggests both the extent to which Beck has become a part of popular culture and some idea of his notoriety, at least in some corners. Beck has constructed an entire parallel universe of an America under siege from progressives who are plotting to transform the United States into a state-controlled socialist or worse, communist state. Using innuendo, chop logic, guilt by association, conspiracy theories, progressive and liberal boogeyman, and a carefully cultivated righteous indignation, Beck presents himself as a modern-day Paul Revere, sounding the alarm to unsuspecting citizens who are not aware that the enemy is at the gate, or to use Beck's more recent term, they are actually in the house. In his broadcast, Beck uses all the tricks of a showman propagandist. He makes absurd comparisons, uses false analogies, and tells big lies. There's no other more charitable way to describe what he does. He weeps as if on cue. There's a YouTube film showing him using small swipes of mentholatum under his eyes to induce tears, which he lapses into frequently. And he lapses into sophomoric lampooning, mocking, ridicule, sarcasm, taunting, and joking. In many ways, the television shows resemble a circus sideshow. As Alex Koppelman observes, he laughs, he cries, he pouts, he giggles, he makes funny faces and grins like a cartoon character. He makes earnest faces, yet insists he is a clown. He comports like a victim of St. Vitus's dance. His means of communicating are, in other words, so wide-ranging as to suggest derangement as much as versatility. What is particularly seductive about Beck's performance, and I believe that would be the best word to describe what he does, is that he wears a variety of masks that he puts off and on with a sort of deft sleight of face to both engage, mesmerize, and inflame his audience, alternately charming and inciting them, making them laugh one minute and ready to storm the Bastille the next. It is this mixture of clownish behavior and apparently deadly seriousness that I believe accounts for Beck's appeal for a certain portion of the populace. That is, his charm, boyish good looks, adolescent pranks, and jokes keep his audience entertained so that when he switches to the latest, quote, progressive crime or misdemeanor, administrative malfeasance, or the most recent threat to freedom and free enterprise, his audience is all too ready to follow him to the outer edges of outrage. Beck describes what he does as a fusion of entertainment and enlightenment, although after observing him for a year, I have discovered precious little of the enlightenment part of that dichotomy, or pairing. His method is effective. When he shifts into his latest example of evil or corruption in the White House or Congress, his listeners or viewers are ready to pick up their plowshares and turn them into swords, or to join the crusade. In fact, until recently, at the opening of his show, Beck would say, repeating the words of Jesus to his disciples, "Come, follow me." There's little doubt that this allusion was intentional, as was his sarcastic remark during the last Supreme Court hearings, "What would Sonia do?" The idea of what would Jesus do. Beck's TV persona is carefully crafted. He begins with a montage of patriotic pictures: George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Martin Luther King, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. His most important prop is a blackboard in which he scribbles face photos and juxtaposes ominous images. Altogether, Obama, Marx, Lenin, Hitler, Saddam Hussein, Hugo Chavez, Che Guevara, et al. In this pose, Beck becomes a professor of a popular uprising, teaching his viewers the real American history, instructing them in all the secret combinations of the Obama administration, warning them of the potential dangers to their freedom and security. Like his fellow travelers on radio and television, Beck sees America as having gone to hell in a liberal-slash-progressive handbasket, warns his viewers that the Republic is in imminent danger and that he and they are called to save it, quote, from ruin, by following him and uniting behind his banner. In almost every broadcast, Beck warns that the impending apocalypse is upon us, and that if one looks closely enough, one can see that all four horsemen have the visage of Barack Hussein Obama. All this might be the story of just one more charismatic right-wing media personality that Mormons would find either persuasive or repulsive, were it not for the fact that Beck is a Latter-day Saint. And not just any Latter-day Saint, but the most visible and controversial one in the nation. That is, Beck is better known than President Monson or Steve Young. He's more popular than Harry Reid or Mitt Romney. He has an enormous following. His daily radio program, carried on 280 stations, has 6.5 million listeners. His television program on Fox has 3 million viewers, and his website, GlennBeck.com, reaches over 1 million monthly visitors. According to a recent Harris poll, Beck finished second only to Oprah Winfrey as America's, quote, favorite TV personality. And if one considers the political influence of their respective followers, Beck's is clearly more engaged and influential than Oprah's. Another poll showed him as more popular than anyone except Nelson Mandela. Beck is a shameless promoter of all things Beck. On radio, TV, and his blog, he entices people to buy his books, subscribe to his newsletter, buy his CDs and videos, attend his public appearances, whether live or via satellite, etc. His latest, and I would say most shameful, promotion is for a new program he calls Insider Extreme, which, if you reversed it, might describe Beck, Extremer Insider. Which has, quote, 6 new camera broadcasts, quality stream of the radio program, with more cameras, more truth, more glam. The promotion will come on for those considering subscribing for only $6.26 a month is, want to be happy? Then subscribe to Insider Extreme. Latter-day Saints have an ambivalent attitude toward Brother Beck, as some call him. For some, the very fact that he is Mormon is enough for them to like him. For others, the view is much less favorable in spite of the fact that he's Mormon. One blogger summed it up beautifully. Glenn Beck is a complex figure, especially for Mormons. In an article in the Sunstone blog titled Glenn Beck, Cleon Skousen, America, Vespucci, and Me, Eric Samuelson speaks of Beck's popularity and considerable influence among Mormons. Samuelson says, "A large number of Utahns have been watching Glenn Beck and taking him very seriously." Speaking of the Obama Democrat health care bill, Samuelson observes, "For many of my LDS brothers and sisters, Obamacare is a catastrophe, the apocalypse, the end of everything good. I felt for years," he says, "that the best guide to the Mormon zeitgeist is letters to the editor page of the Deseret News. If that's true, then Utah Mormons are collectively losing their cool." President Obama is routinely described as a socialist, a fascist, a Maoist, and a communist, all of this coming right off of Glenn Beck's blackboard. His administration is seen as something dark and seductively satanic. Our nation is descending into chaos and anarchy, where in the last days we're just about beyond redemption. That theme is almost every night on Beck. Beck's broadcasts also reflect Mormon myths, practices, jargon, and symbols. In a recent show, he said, "I'm a gospel-believing brother. I think it's safe to say that some of if some Beck's listeners would be alarmed to know exactly what gospel Beck is a brother in, that is, the more fundamentalist or evangelical followers who may not be aware that he's Mormon. But it is in positioning himself in a way that he can speak in the same language to Mormons and to fundamentalists, Christians who consider Mormons a non-Christian cult, that makes Beck's strategy so brilliant. In more favorable reviews, Beck tends to reflect his portrayal of the Desert Book DVD, Unlikely Mormon, the conversion story of Glenn Beck, or the favorable response to the many verbal and graphic allusions to Mormonism that Beck tends to sprinkle throughout his broadcasts, photos of Mormon temples, which I'm sure that many of his viewers have no idea what they're looking at, stories of Mormon pioneers, Mormon hymns, Mormon scriptures, and doctrine, although usually not identified as such. Typical of these are the following from the Millennial Star blog. I watched the DVD Unlikely Mormon Glenn Beck the other night, and I was really moved. I loved hearing his story. Everyone in my family was really inspired. I know some people's personalities don't mention with Glenn's, but as a person who has met him face to face, I have to say he has an incredible spirit and a desire to do good. I admire this greatly. Anyone who is courageous enough to take a stand like he does is worthy of respect in my book, even if I don't completely agree with him. Another one said, I met Beck after one of his shows a few years ago, back before all the security, when he was free to meet and greet guests. And I actually did feel the spirit, pretty strong too. Two recent articles by Latter-day Saint writers tend to view Beck in a less favorable light. In an article titled Mormon Like Me, Black Saints, Bigots, and Beck, Margaret Blair Young speaks of growing up in Provo during the 60s, the same time that Darius Gray, her Black Latter-day Saint co-author, director, and producer, did. Young speaks of the climate in Provo during that time that made Darius and other Blacks so fearful. She then tells of a recent experience of being with Darius in Marshall, Missouri, his ancestral home, recounting the, quote, sad history in Missouri in which Blacks were lynched and Mormons driven from their homes. Young tells of seeing on the library rack the just-published issue of Time magazine with a full-color photo of Beck sticking out his tongue, as Young remarks, quote, like a petulant four-year-old. Shocked at what she sees, she says, why did Beck's infantile sneer matter to me? Because Beck is a Mormon. Because his mocking presence in the small town of Marshall, Missouri, meant he was sticking his tongue out at patrons in every library in the nation. Because the city of Provo, Utah, where I still live and now teach, sometimes invites him to be part of our Freedom Festival and host our Stadium of Fire, as though his ultra-right, self-assured conviction and his bifurcated view of contemporary issues comprised a worthy resume. One of my friends at BYU complained that on at least two different 4th of July celebrations in Provo, four states got together and invited and paid for Sean Hannity to be the speaker. Yikes. Because Beck is a disciple of Cleon Skousen, because he is a disciple of W. Cleon Skousen, whose conspiracy theories resulted in students spying on each other and on the professors at BYU and fomented terror and suspicion throughout Provo, even Provo High, and created a climate which made Darius fear for his family's life. Because Beck has said such race-baiting things as, this President Obama has exposed himself as a guy who has a deep-seated hatred of white people or the white culture. Perhaps that is why Glenn Beck's mocking, dismissive, sneering tongue and absurdly furrowed brow provoked me to epithets I would not normally use. He is inviting me and any who will listen to the world I was terrified of as a child, and which, by the time I was in high school, I realized was an outlandishly hokey creation. A world which invents and obsesses on cloak conspiracies, a world which encourages racial division, a world which loops a soundbite, not God bless America, but, and calls it an identity, a world which reduces the president to a well-spoken, quote, credit to his race guy, a well-spoken credit to his race guy who hates white people. He exhumed skeletons from our closets, and Beck exhumed skeletons from our closets and coffins, and unholy passions from our past, which should stay buried, or be instantly cremated if they still happen yet to be hovering. For me, as a Mormon, Glenn Beck's invitation to return to childish things forces me to confront anew the unsavory aspects of my religion's past, and all the things we Latter-day Saints are now attempting to heal. There is no question that Beck has been influential in resurrecting Skousen from, as one critic calls it, the dustbin of history. So important an influence on Beck's life is Skousen that Beck's biographer has called him the man who changed Beck's life. Beck has touted Skousen's The 5,000-Year Leap, a new edition for which he wrote the introduction, as a, quote, must read. He touts it frequently on his shows. In his foreword, Beck speaks of his discovery of Skousen in terms that most Mormons would associate with divine intervention. He says that once when he was walking down the avenues of the Americas, it could have been Madison Avenue, in Manhattan, the answer came to me, he said. It was so dramatic that it made me stop in the middle of the sidewalk. The answer was obvious, and best of all, the thinking and worrying had already been done for me. The questions that we face were foreseen by the greatest group of Americans who ever lived, our founding fathers. In language strangely reminiscent of the Book of Mormon, Beck adds, they knew we would be grappling with issues like the ones we face today. They knew that we would eventually lose our way and that we would need a beacon to lead us on our way back. Several weeks after this revelation, as Beck calls it, he says, a friend, without solicitation, sent me a copy of Skousen's book. Beck ends his foreword by telling his readers in urgent, dramatic language, you, me, all of us were born for this day to stand responsible before God and future generations to keep this torch of freedom lit and bear it away from ruin. He then asks his readers to make him four promises: to read Skousen's book immediately, certainly within the next 30 days, to share it with all of their friends, to share it with their children, to memorize its 28 main ideas, and to do it now, he says, is the time. Promise me. For Latter-day Saints who accept the idea of personal revelation, of America as a promised land, and the Constitution is divinely inspired, and for whom the idea of promises or covenants are central to their religion, such an appeal is seductive. Some Mormons, however, especially those of an older generation, who remember the negative influence of Skousen and the Birch Society that they had on the church, might be a little more skeptical, or at least a little more hesitant, about jumping on Beck's bandwagon. On what's going on at Fox News, conservative commentator David Frum speaks of Skousen as, quote, one of the legendary cranks of the conservative world, a John Bircher, a grand fantasist of theories about secret conspiracies between capitalists and communists to impose a one-world government under the control of David Rockefeller. It seems inevitable that with such a mentor as Skousen, Beck would identify with the John Birch Society. In fact, Ben has been instrumental in the Birch Society's recent resurgence. In an interview with John Birch Society spoke in San Antonio, Beck said, I have to tell you, when I was growing up, the John Birch Society, I thought they were a bunch of nuts. However, you guys are starting to make a lot more sense to me. Apparently, as Beck is unaware that in 1963, the first presidency stated, we deplore the presumption of some politicians, especially officers, coordinators, and members of the John Birch Society, who undertake to align the church or its leadership with their partisan views. President Hubie Brown made notes after a meeting with President McKay, in which he said, we agree that we had done the right thing in letting the members of the church and the world know that the church does not in any way endorse or subscribe to the John Birch Society. Later, Apostle Ezra Taft Benson was attempting to get picture of David McKay on the cover of the John Birch Society magazine. He was going about it in a very serious way. In fact, they already, I think, had the cover already when President McKay found out about it and said, I don't want to have anything to do with John Birch. Well, when I have a slight confession here, make a disclosure. Clan Skousen was my teacher and the advisor of the BYU debate team, of which I was a member. The question we debated that year was, should the United States extend recognition to Communist China? So you can imagine how much influence. And for a period, I too was believed in that dark and spiritual world that Skousen and others painted. I too believed that our country was on the precipice of a communist occupation, as Joe McCarthy claimed. As one Mormon blogger had written, I had many devout friends who truly believed that Joseph McCarthy was right, and there were communists and communist sympathizers who were working in concert to undermine our government. The lowest grade I got in Skousen's class was a 98, but I got a B, and this is not being vindictive. Some see best tactics as similar to McCarthy's, especially his propensity to see a socialist communist bear behind every progressive bush and his outing of those he considers socialist and communist. In an article titled Glenn Beck, Joe McCarthy Lives, Los Angeles Times writer Bill Press sees striking similarities between McCarthy's 1950s witch hunts and what Beck is doing today. There's an entire website, in fact, devoted to this called GlennMcCarthyBeck.com. Well, I don't have time to give you all that I've done. This is part of a long and growing article that I expect is going to be published soon in Sunstone. Let me switch to some of the things that have to do with Beck's Mormonism that I think may be more significant than what we're talking about here. Joanna Brooks, in an article titled How Mormonism Built Glenn Beck, argues that it was Beck's conservatism that really drew him to Mormonism. That explains that more than anything else. And she talks about Beck's viewing this his conversion narrative. And she said, I was baptized on Sunday, and on Monday, Beck soap tightens again. He wipes tears from his eyes with his index finger. 2 days later, Beck was offered his own political talk show. Beck talks about this as if it really were the divine intervention, and you know, again, we're very familiar with this. I joined the church on Monday, and on Wednesday, all of my debts were forgiven, and I was made CEO of my company, or whatever else happens. She speaks of this as spiritual narratives of the "I once was lost, and now I'm financially sound" variety, which are commonplace in Mormonism. One wishes that instead of latching onto some of the worst ideas in the Mormon fringe, Beck's political and social persona would be more reflective of gospel principles, more in tune with the New Testament, the Book of Mormon, and the more enlightened teachings of the Restoration. There is a dramatic disconnect between the gospel of Christ and the critical pejorative, mean-spirited labeling, name-calling, and downright nastiness characteristic of Beck's most of Beck's broadcasts. Where in Beck's universe, one wonders, is the Sermon on the Mount, King Benjamin's address, or the 121st section of the Doctrine and Covenants? Where, for that matter, are the long-held Latter-day Saint principles of respect for civil authorities? Has Beck read the 134th section of the Doctrine and Covenants, which states, we believe that every man should be honored in his station, rulers and magistrates as such? I don't know if it was aimed at Beck, but a statement on the Church's News website last October could certainly apply to him, called the Mormon Ethic of Civility. It states, so many of the habits and conventions of modern culture undermine the virtues and manners that make peaceful coexistence in a plural society possible. The fabric of civil society tears when stretched thin by its extremities. Civility is not only a matter of discourse, it's a primary mode of engagement. The Church adds, the Church views with concern the politics of fear and rhetorical extremism that render civil discussion impossible. The Church hopes that our democratic system will facilitate kinder and more reasoned exchanges among fellow Americans than we are now seeing. Emphasizing the core gospel values of its position, the Mormon Ethic of Civility states, "The moral basis of civility is the golden rule taught by a broad range of cultures and individuals, perhaps most popularly by Jesus of Nazareth. The ethic of reciprocity reminds us all of our responsibility toward one another and reinforces the communal nature of human life. Beck should know this, since the one class he took before dropping out of Yale was early Christology." A bit of irony there. "If Beck is unaware of such core Mormon values, he also seems unaware of, or is indifferent to, the fact that some of his fellow saints are liberal progressives, or that there is a group called Mormons for Equality and Social Justice. Further, he seems insensitive to the fact that hundreds of thousands of Latter-day Saints live happily and with the full blessings of the Church in countries with socialist governments. The Church's statement on civility recognizes the virtue of pluralism in an international church. Quote, the needs for civility is perhaps most relevant in the realm of partisan politics, as the Church operates in countries around the world and embraces the richness of pluralism. Thus, the political diversity of Latter-day Saints spans the ideological spectrum." Another troubling image out of Mormon mythology that Beck has latched onto with particular passion is the infamous White Horse prophecy. You can see echoes of it throughout Beck's broadcast. The prediction attributed to Joseph Smith, but disavowed by contemporary church leaders, that at some future point the Constitution of the United States will be in danger and hang by a thread, and if so, will be rescued because of the intervention of the elders of Israel. Beck's behavior and his rhetoric seem heavily influenced by this Mormon belief. An interview he conducted with Mormon Senator Orrin Hatch confirms this. Beck, "Senator, do you believe, when I heard Barack Obama talk about the Constitution, I thought, we are at the point, or are we very near the point, where our Constitution is hanging by a thread." One of the real ironies is, here's Beck, who's never been to college, and I don't think has read anything besides Skousen, who criticizes Obama, who is a constitutional teacher and professor and lawyer, as not understanding the Constitution. Anyway, I thought we're at the point where this our Constitution is hanging by a thread, and Hatch says, "You got that right." Beck says, we are so close to losing our Constitution. We're so close to losing what we have, and people aren't thinking. The next generation, our children, look at us and say, you sold our freedom for what? Hatch says, well, let me tell you something. I believe the Constitution is hanging by a thread. One can almost imagine Beck seeing himself as one of those elders called to, quote, rally the righteous of our country and provide the necessary balance and strength to save the institutions of constitutional government. I'm quoting now from, I think, Brigham Young in the White Horse Prophecy. To be one of those who, quote, will step forth and save the Constitution from utter destruction to rescue that great and glorious palladium of our liberty. To the extent that he does see himself in such a role, Beck likely considers that he is on a divinely appointed mission to fulfill modern-day prophecy. The Church has legitimate reasons to fear the extreme rhetoric of someone like Beck. If some of the more violent messages one hears and sees on his programs, or from the Tea Partiers and other anti-government groups who have expressed such violent sentiments toward Obama specifically, and toward his policies in general, were to lead to violence against the president, which is a real possibility, given the fact that so many leaders have been assassinated or violently attacked in recent American history. And people like Beck, who have fomented the anger and hatred, could legitimately be held responsible, even if they make attempts, as Beck sometimes does, to warn his viewers against violence. It's interesting to speculate what influence. That is, if you think about, and just look at what's happened the past week, when with the passage of the health care bill and all of the violent rhetoric, which now begins starting to be translated into racial, homophobic, violent acts and language. It's not too far from that to somebody actually, especially now that people can carry guns any place on the planet, or certainly in America, that violence could be done to the president. And one thinks about the implications of that, that a Latter-day Saint advocating violence and who accuses the president of being a racist and a communist, who identifies the president with Hitler and with Mao and with Stalin and with all these other people, that someone could feel that it is their job to save America. Think of the implications of what that might mean for the church. Speculate what influence Beck might have on our on Mitt Romney's presidential ambitions. Just as with his ambiguous stance towards Sarah Palin, potential rival in 2012, one can imagine Romney being caught between wanting to capitalize on Beck's popularity, especially the far right that Romney likely needs if he's going to have a chance of capturing the White House, and his concern that association with Beck might negatively impact his recent attack to the center, or at least his avowed attack to the center. In a recent article entitled "New and Improved Romney," David Bernstein reveals the new Romney strategy, which includes distancing himself from the far right, including being willing to surrender most of the South, and moving more toward what many consider his true moderate position. If so, Beck could present a problem by confirming the impression many moderates already have of Romney's more conservative position, and worse, his chameleon-like reputation. On the other hand, judging from some of his recent statements, Romney seems to be having a hard time truly moving to the center. At times, his remarks seem closer to Beck's extreme rhetoric than those of a true moderate. For example, at the recent CPAC conference, Romney referred to the Obama administration as liberal neo-monarchism, a phrase that could have come right out of Skousen via Beck. In a recent, on his website, Beck links his diatribe against the health care bill to a recent diatribe of Romney's, which again sounds much more like Beck than anything toward the center. In an article titled "Latter-day Taint," Glenn Beck is driven by Mormonism and why his fellow faithful, including Mitt Romney, should be worried. Adam Riley of the Boston Phoenix writes, "Should members of the LDS Church be cheering or lamenting Beck's protracted moment in the spotlight? I wish it were a moment, but it seems more and more a lot longer than that. Could Beck's 4 ways into self-Mormon sermonizing make his conservative and evangelical fans rethink their loyalty? And if Beck's religiosity finally becomes a story, what might that mean for the lingering presidential hopes of Republican contender Mitt Romney? If Beck's recent alienation of a broad swath of Christians on his social gospel comments is not, if it's not addressed quickly and successfully, it could indeed prove problematic for Romney. Mormon writer Joanna Brooks cites a letter from a Presbyterian friend in Atlanta who says, "Beck has gone too far this time. The only thing that's going to come of this is that Christians in the South will dislike Mormons even more than they do now." The problem for Mormons, I think, is that Beck is unlikely to change his bombastic, confrontational, aggressive style or to be deterred from his self-appointed mission to rescue the nation and set things aright. Reinforcing this conclusion is the fact that Beck has an addictive personality and is a recovering alcohol and drug addict. Since becoming a Mormon, one could argue that Beck seems to have replaced abusive substances with the adrenaline rush of celebrity, notoriety, and wealth. I don't wish to be unfair to Beck, but having grown up in a family of addicts, I recognize some of the signs in his behavior. Beyond this, Beck is fabulously wealthy, earning this year an estimated $25 million. In fact, his vast media enterprise, his successful book sales, being on the New York Times bestseller list 4 times. And an article in the Deseret News a couple of years ago, the interviewer speaks of Beck having, quote unquote, written this book or, quote unquote, written another book. If you try to read his book, Arguing with Idiots, it is the most unreadable book I've ever read. And I've read lots of unreadable books in my life. I think it's unlikely that Beck will surrender such fame and wealth, or that he will modify his style in a way that would diminish his colossal media power. In fact, Beck has become such a celebrity, such an oversized figure on the political landscape, whose reputation for good or ill will likely to continue to grow, that one wonders what impact he will have on the church and its central mission. It is safe to say that many of Beck's non-Mormon followers, who include evangelicals and fundamentalists, may have difficulty reconciling their devotion to him with his Mormonness. On the other hand, some may be willing to overlook his religion because of the fervor they feel for the cause he represents. Among the moderate to liberal populace, who because of the church's past history of racism, its recent involvement in Proposition 8, its association with Mormon fundamentalism, and its general conservatism, they may be inclined to see Beck as confirmation of what they already are convinced is Mormon fundamentalism or even weirdness. For such people, it's hard to see Beck's identification of Mormonism as being positive for the church. A recent episode on Beck's radio and TV program illustrates the risk that Beck represents to the church. And this is the episode you're all familiar of, where he talked about if people see the word social justice or economic justice on their church marquee or in their church bulletin, they should run as fast as they can. Social justice and economic justice are just code words. And in case anybody can't get the code, a few minutes later, Beck pulls up a swastika and a hammer and sickle, identifying these with social justice. Communism on the left, Nazis on the right, he says, am I advising people to leave the church? Yes, he does. And he later said to people should, if they see this, if they see their church pushing social justice, he said, go find another parish, go alert your bishop. I was tempted to go alert my bishop, but then I remembered. Probably wasn't a good idea. Well, when I saw this, I said to myself, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. Is he totally unaware of the degree where social justice, social and economic justice are woven not only into the fabric of American history, but to the gospel itself? I was therefore not surprised to see a tremendous reaction to Beck's words, and you've read about this with Jim Wallace, the head of Sojourners, a Christian group that really is very much involved in social justice causes, wrote an article on, several articles on the Huffington Post, said the Bible is clear, the Mosaic Law, that if you believe the Hebrew prophet Jesus Christ, social justice is an integral part of God's plan for humanity. And he invited Christians to send Beck a letter telling them that they didn't have any problems with this. Well, tens of thousands of people have written such letters, and in a New York Times article out read by Glenn Beck, Salvo Christians Fired Back, it points out that Beck, the reaction is also among Mormons because Beck was, they saw him, Beck is attacking his own church. Philip Barlow said a lot of Latter-day Saints think that Beck was asking them to leave their own church. One way to read the Book of Mormon is that it's a vast tract on social justice. Marlowe notes that Beck's position is at variance with the Church's recent addition of caring for the poor to the list of its central missions. Responding to such criticism the next day, Beck tried to spin his words and blame the New York Times, which he called the organ of the Obama administration. He called Jim Wallace a leftist, an operative of the Democratic Party, an apologist communist, for the atrocities in Cambodia and Vietnam, and so on. And then Beck, which is typical, the next day threatened Wallace. He said to Wallace, speaking to him, the hammer is coming, and when the hammer comes, it's going to be hammering hard and all through the night, over and over. Absolute violent threat to Wallace. Well, some of you may have seen the cartoon in Sunday's New York Times that shows three pictures of Jesus, and on the bottom it says, if Jesus returned as Glenn Beck. The first one, Jesus is saying, don't heal the sick, that's socialism. The second says, don't shelter the homeless, that's communism. The third says, don't feed the hungry, that's Nazism. Well, a number of Latter-day Saints in the Deseret News and elsewhere have responded to Beck's absolute distortion of the Mormon gospel. Well, there's a lot more that I could say, but let me close by I was back in an interview with Doug Robinson, the Deseret News. Back talks about really wrestling with being a Mormon. First, I told people there I was a Mormon all the time, but as I became more and more converted and saw others in the church I wanted to be like, I stopped saying it. I didn't want people to think that's the way Mormons are. Apparently changing mind because since then he's referred to as religion numerous times. By the way, when Beck was in his ward, his name came up to be ordained to the priesthood, one brother raised his hand against that ordination, which I thought took a bit of courage. Anyway, he talks about his language being loose, and every day he says, I get off of the air, I think, Lord, help me to be better. Why is this happening? How do I balance this, he says to God, and be a good reflection of you? He says, I don't think I did it very often. Most Mormons, I think, would agree. Well, I think the church has a challenge in regard to Glenn Beck. Part of that challenge is that with the Deseret News having produced this DVD, this glowing hagiographic conversion story, and with so many Mormons following Glenn Beck, I mean, in the past month, I've had two friends tell me that their mothers who live in Utah, that my friend says, I can't have a conversation with him about Glenn Beck, because they listen to him, they watch him every night, and they think that he is the most inspired person that they've ever met, and they're very scared about what's happening in this country. I think there is a great challenge for the church as to what they're going to do with a person who's becoming more and more popular, has a bigger and bigger following. He serves in his ward, teaches priesthood, is a ward missionary with his wife, and his works in the church addiction counseling program. I understand he has a temple to recommend. Undoubtedly plays a humongous amount of tithing, but there is such a disconnect between that Sunday behavior and persona and what one sees that it seems to me is a kind of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, a Mormonism that pretends real problems for the church. Well, if I were his bishop or his stake president, that would be interesting. I would counsel him to be more temperate, to be less radical, to read Jean England, to read Lowell Bennion and Laura Ulrich and Claudia Bushman, Levi Peterson and Margaret Young, among others. I tell him to read other historians besides Skousen, and to read a lot of the books that he missed because he didn't get a liberal education. Especially I would ask him to read Nephi and King Benjamin and Alma and Moroni, and especially the words of Jesus. As a liberal, progressive, intellectual Latter-day Saint, I have difficulty finding myself in Glenn Beck's America, or at least feeling safe there. But there's room in my America, in my church, and even in my heart for Glenn Beck. Nevertheless, I have an increasingly difficult time of trying to reconcile who he is with the religion to which we both give allegiance. I'm closing now. I began by seeing Beck as a comic curiosity. The more I've listened to him, the more I've watched him, the more I've read and tried to read his books, the more my focus has shifted from curiosity to concern. The more I've learned about Beck's life story, the trajectory of his personal career, his conversion to Mormonism, and his gravitation toward the extremes of both Mormon and American culture, coupled with his growing popularity, the more my concern has turned to what can best be described as alarm. Rather than just being another wacky, out-of-control entertainer or news personality, Beck has evolved into a figure I consider among the most dangerous in America, and I'm not usually given to hyperbole. While I can rejoice that Beck has found the gospel, I cannot rejoice in behavior that is so radically divergent from the gospel behavior that might be labeled from and divergent from that gospel, his behavior that might be labeled unbecoming of a Latter-day Saint. The danger he represents to the church is that with his open confession of his Mormon faith, others will confuse his values and behavior as reflecting of the religion I believe and love. Thank you.
Is there anyone in the room that can represent the majority of members of the church and their attitude towards Glenn Beck? Is there anyone here that can do that? Okay, someone in the back.
No, actually, I don't know if I want to do that, but I just had one thought about that. Is it possible that Glenn Beck appeals to kind of our natural man?
Which would suggest we're hearing scriptures that he is an enemy to God?
Well, I don't know.
Which is what the Book of Mormon says, a natural man is an enemy to God.
I don't know, it's just like, is it kind of like fun? Or maybe it's, you know, you already talked about him being an entertainer. Is that, is it in some sense, you know, it's enjoyable and people, you know, get confused between the enjoyment they get from
that's why I consider him dangerous, because a lot of people, I think, can see that.
Can you restate the question?
Can't we just look at him as appealing to our natural proclivity to have fun and enjoy something which is entertaining and comedic? If it weren't the masks that come off and on, and sometimes the seamless movement between them, I find him highly entertaining. I think he's a very funny guy, and I think he's a very gifted comedian. But it's for that very reason that I think many of his followers don't distinguish from that. In fact, I think the one thing I used to introduce, I think the comedic aspect of him is seductive. People get laughing and they're having a good time, and then suddenly they're in another sphere in which they're being warned that the devil is at the gate.
I guess kind of as a follow-up, there's a book by Amos Goiora, this guy that was who's in the Jewish Special Forces, I think, in Israel. Now he's in the University of Utah. He proposed that we should consider limiting the free speech of certain religious extremists because they are promoting terrorism. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. I don't know if
you summarize that one.
The question is whether or not one should limit the free speech rights of extremists. As a professor of literature, I am a great believer in the First Amendment, and I think the best anecdote for Glenn Beck is for more people to call him on what is happening to him. I don't see. I think that is a treacherous road once you go down it, but I do think that there's reason to fear. I think, for example, if Beck criticizes Obama for not being serious enough that we are at war, and we indeed are at war, then I feel that what Beck is saying could be considered sedition. I mean, it's that serious, what he says about Obama. I mean, night after night, he savages the president. He cannot say anything about him as positive. What he says is negative, only foments what I think is hatred of the president. But nevertheless, I wouldn't go that far. Yes?
Yeah, but I the thing I was kind of curious about is, you know, given his, you know, strong beliefs and practice of Mormonism, you know, juxtaposition against what you see as his highly inflammatory, you know, one of the most dangerous men in America, to paraphrase your concluding statement.
Yeah, quoting me exactly, not paraphrasing.
I guess quoting me exactly. But anyway, have any people in his, like, his state president or anybody higher up in the church saying, well, you know, what you're saying may be detrimental to the image of the church, you know, maybe, you know, not directly referring to, you know, possibly Mitt Romney running for president and the damage that it could do to him, but, you know, the damage that it would maybe do to the image of the larger church, which you suggested in your talk, has anybody called him in and said...
The question is whether or not any church leader has spoken to Beck specifically...
To this problem.
About his behavior. Well, apparently the Christian State President haven't, or the habit hasn't done any good, because you see nothing has changed. Whether or not, I think the brethren would hesitate to do this, although I understand that a church leader did call Jim Wallace and apologize for the rhetoric that Beck was using against him. But I think the church is in a quandary because there are so many Mormons who love Beck and think that what he's doing, in fact, is going to save the Republic. So I think the church is caught. I think the statement that came in October, which apparently flew over Beck's head, my feeling is it must have been aimed at people like him because it is so specific about the dangers of extreme rhetoric.
Anybody else want to defend Beck? Is there any? There's a Beck defender, okay.
I live in the epicenter of Uzbekistan along the Wasatch Front, and I have been struggling for some time now to try to figure out a healthy, constructive way to engage his, for want of a better word, his disciples, his followers, and you know, trying to exercise some empathy to understand really what is it that resonates with this particular worldview. And not to be pejorative, because I know this will sound pejorative, but more often than not, the people who attach themselves with this worldview are very binary and simple-minded. And I don't mean simple-minded in terms of simplicity, being able to condense the complex into
synthesis.
I mean simple-minded in the sense of simpleton-minded, who really cannot go beyond a binary black and white, and just for want of intellectual training or personality, that all the grain, the nuance between the two extremes are impossible territory for them to tread.
Now, this brother spoke of living along the Wasatch Front in Uzbekistan country.
So he didn't defend Glenn very well. Does somebody else want to defend him?
The difficulty of engaging in conversation with people who have a binary view of the world, which is absolutely defines Beck. I mean, there is no gray in Beck's world. And the people who... And it's, again, this is why McCarthy and Skousen were so popular, is that one wants to believe that if the Republic is in jeopardy and about to be overtaken by the enemy, and the enemy is within... that, and even in McCarthy time, and there were some church leaders as well who believed that President Eisenhower was a communist and that he was part of the communist column in America. When you have that sense, and again, so much of our scripture, so much of our tradition points to this, especially if you believe the White Oak prophecy, then here comes someone riding on a white horse who's going to save us. People want that. We want to be saved from destruction, from these people who are going to, you know, put us into economic captivity and sell us down the river and all of this other stuff. So it's very seductive. And as I say, I think the anecdote of that is for enough people who don't believe that and to see that to have the courage enough to counter it. But the fact of the matter is there are a lot of people who are really angry. That's what these two men were saying to me about their mothers. They're angry with him if they start saying, well, Mom, Glenn Beck is... No. He is, you know, for them, he's a modern-day prophet. Yes, back in the back there.
Since we've had our difficulties with Muslim extremism in the world, we have often been counseled that we need to look at the root causes of those kinds of reactions. And I think a similar observation is applicable here. For sake of full disclosure, I should let everybody know that for years I have been a voting libertarian, a member of the Libertarian Party. And I have to say that as a libertarian, I share a great deal of the concern of the people who are in the Tea Party movement and lots of other places that Glenn Beck exploits in his program. I don't think it's ridiculous to believe that there are genuine reasons to be concerned about the loss of personal liberty in this country. to be concerned about the loss of economic liberty, and to be concerned about a lot of other things that people like Ron Paul are concerned about. And he's no Glenn Beck. So my cautionary word here is that let's make sure that what we are deploring, and certainly what I deplore, is Glenn Beck's overheated rhetoric, his Manichaean thinking, which I agree with you he has, and all the rest of that. But it is not unreasonable to have the kinds of concerns that he has, it seems to me, as a contemporary American. So I don't know if that's intended as a support for...
Moss talks about the fact that there are a number of things that people like Glenn Beck talk about, which would be concern about debt, concern about overextending ourselves in terms of government power and authority, in terms of a number of things that particularly libertarians might be concerned about. But I think that concern I see is much broader than what libertarians do. I think that there is, in fact, a general disquietude in the United States about these things. It is the polarization that seems to me not to lead to a resolution of those issues or problems, but rather to make them more extreme. That is, the more we get into camps and excommunicate one another, the more we demonize others, the less I think we're, and you can see this, if we are to solve those problems, we have to come together to do them. And the polarization that one sees and that I think Beck foments, and I think Romney now is fomenting more than he has in the past, gets us out of dialogue, gets us out of problem solution. But the problem's real, and I think it's important to remember that, one of the last conversations I had, one of the only conversations I had with Hubie Brown was when he was in the hospital and he was quite ill. And Jane England and I went to see him. And we were talking at the time about some of these social problems and issues in the church. And Brother Brown said, remember that at the heart of every revolution, there's an important truth. Well, whatever the Tea Partiers and others represent in terms of a revolution, there is a truth there. And it's good to be reminded of that, especially in raising his hand.
This will be the last question, then we'll have to dismiss.
Oh, no, let's go on about longer. Sorry to overrule the chair, but I don't think the next group goes here until 11:15 today.
No, 11 o'clock.
11 o'clock?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, since I think I'm such a big part of that, maybe. Okay.
I was just going to say that I think the problem is my political evolution went from being a fan of Ezra Temperance and then when I first joined the church to where I am now. The problem is that the American people as a whole really don't want to be bothered with having to figure all this stuff out. You know, we're so busy making, want to make a living, we want to make money, we want the simple answers. And so we get Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck up there giving people simple answers because they really don't want to take the time to really study it out and figure it out.
Well, a friend of mine, I was traveling in China with a group of American writers, and over some meal, Gary Lopez, one of the American writers, said, we were talking about South Africa and what had happened there, and he said, you know what explains South Africa more than anything else? And I said, well, I said, South Africa missed the Enlightenment. And I think what explains Glenn Beck is Glenn Beck has missed liberal education. He talks about the Enlightenment, but he does not have, I think, the ability to truly discriminate or be self-critical or to weigh things. He seems to have bought a extreme rhetoric in Mormonism as well as in American politicalism that obviates any need to challenge or self-question or to consider other points of view. And that's why I find him dangerous to the church and to the nation.
Just one point of context outside of the Mormon tradition, but within the American political tradition. In 1935, the two people that FDR feared most were Huey Long of Louisiana and Father Coughlin, a Roman Catholic priest in Royal Oak, Michigan. Father Coughlin's Sunday night radio broadcasts in the 30s became so famous and so popular and so anti-Semitic that the United States Post Office built what is today still a bulk post office in what was a hamlet of Royal Oak. And it got to be so notorious that finally his church did intervene, and the Archbishop of Detroit silenced Father Coughlin, and he spent the next 25 years serving as a parish priest, engaged in real estate transactions mainly in Royal Oak.
Now, some people, in fact, refer to Glenn Beck as the Mormon father of Coughlin. I teach irony. There is a certain irony about a Latter-day Saint I know who published an op-ed piece in the Salt Lake Tribune about Proposition 8, and it was silenced for for a year for having done so. And some of my Glenn Beck not being silenced.
Okay, thank you very much.